This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Welcome to the Friday Pitch-In, where we end each week with an hour of Indiana-focused radio, starting with a weekly visit with Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer Lauren Chapman. Lauren, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
It was a week of summer study committees in the news. Before we jump into the headlines, can you give us a quick rundown of what a summer study committee is and what it does?
Absolutely. That's a really good question. So summer study committees are usually put together at the end of the previous legislative session when a bill is going through, and they basically lawmakers look at it and say, actually, I want to think a little bit more about this particular topic. So summer study committees become basically a brainstorming draft of what legislation could come up in the next legislative session. So this year, there was a summer study committee about logging, and there was also one about education governance restructuring.
Okay, well, so let's hit the logging one. This is the forest management debate happening right now. What's the debate at hand?
Right now, they're trying to decide whether or not to increase the amount of old growth forests in the state from 6% to 10%. So it's a 4 percentage point increase. Basically, activists and outdoor recreation businesses really want to see this happen. But the state Department of Natural Resources and the state forester are a little reticent to do that.
You mean they don't want to see it happen? They don't want to see the more logging?
No. That they don't want to see an increase in
logging.
In old growth forests.
Okay. Well, it's those old growth trees that activists and outdoor recreation businesses are particularly looking to have protected, right? The old growth. Why are those trees so important to them?
Because it adds to, it's kind of an aesthetic appeal, right? You know, you see those older trees, you see that old growth forest, and a lot of activists have argued that, you know, that is part of Indiana's history and legacy and that we need to protect that. From a forestry standpoint, however, a lot of folks from that department and as part of a survey, a very unscientific survey that Indiana Public Broadcasting did, a lot of state foresters across the entire United States say, old growth forests might not necessarily be the, you know, the dog that you want to put in your race because you want to encourage biodiversity and you want to encourage younger growth as well, because we don't have wildfires in Indiana the way that we have historically had. We have to kind of manufacture that. And so the DNR is arguing we do that through logging and making a little bit of money off of that while we do it. And activists say we don't want to mess with the ecosystem that way.
So the push to set aside 10% of the state forest land for old growth trees failed in this past legislative session. Where does the debate stand now then? What's next?
Yeah, so that's actually the interesting part. There were 6 hours of testimony from people both for and against increasing the amount of old growth trees and kind of fighting back a little bit on logging. But by the end of that meeting, because it was a 6-hour marathon of testimony, there wasn't a quorum for the summer study committee. So they haven't made any formal recommendations for the new legislative session. But it still seems that, you know, they're still kind of percolating over it. It's a very interesting kind of niche argument. But so they're still kind of gathering that information right now.
All right. Well, chapter two then of the summer study committee series now. Let's pivot to the education edition. Some changes have been proposed to change the governance structure around education in Indiana. House Education Committee Chair Bob Boehning brought an idea to the table recently. Can you explain his proposal?
Absolutely. So everything that was old is new again. And apparently in this edition, everything from 2015 is now gauche. This particular idea was once it's very similar to the former Education Roundtable, which was dissolved in 2015. So instead of having the governor's workforce cabinet, the State Board of Education, and the Department of Education making decisions in their very different silos, Bob Boehning has proposed basically mashing them all together. So between those three organizations, there are more than 40 members that are variously appointed by the governor or elected or appointed by by the state legislature. So they're wanting to streamline that process by taking these three groups and mashing them together. But in that process, creating three subcommittees on pre-K through 12 education, post-secondary education, and workforce development. So giving basically helping align those three organizations a little bit better.
So nothing's actually happened yet, but it's this germ of an idea. Mm-hmm. Why does this matter right now?
Yeah, it's because the state superintendent is actually going to be an appointed position after 2020, after Jennifer McCormick leaves office. So now the leader of the Department of Education is going to be appointed by the governor. The State Board of Education is largely appointed by the governor, and the governor's workforce cabinet is appointed by the governor. So instead of having these three very different silos, it makes a little bit more sense from Banning's perspective to put them all into one.
Well, speaking of State Superintendent Jennifer McCormick, she cites an unhealthy governance structure as part of the reason. Can you talk about the tension here? It's got to be messy if public officials are stepping away because of it.
Yeah, I mean, the Department of Education has kind of a they are supposed to be in charge of education in the state of Indiana, but they have to get things through the state school board, which Indiana is one of the weird ones where the state school board is actually appointed by the governor. I think there are only a handful of other states that are appointed positions as opposed to elected. So with all of these changes being made to Indiana's structure since 2015, with some of those kind of infamous clashes between Governor Pence, then Governor Pence, and Glenda Ritz, lawmakers are wanting to revisit that and figure out if this is one of the solutions to kind of address some of that unhealthy governance.
Well, an acronym that Indiana is all too familiar with made its way back into the headlines this week, RFRA, which of course stands for the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, was in the news again. Lauren, for those of us who need a quick refresher, can you capsule what RFRA was about?
Yeah. Essentially, it was the original version of the bill basically wanted to create a space to protect religious freedom in the state. It was championed by then Governor Mike Pence because, again, everything from 2015 is new again. So that was passed on March 26th, 2015. On April 2nd, 2015, basically the next week, a bill amended that law to add in protections for LGBTQ Hoosiers, basically saying that businesses can't refuse services to people based on sexual orientation and gender identity. But it makes exceptions for churches, church-run schools, and religious nonprofits, which brings us to today.
So what brought RFRA back into the news this week then?
It's actually a 2015 lawsuit. So in December of 2015, the Indiana Family Institute and American Family Association of Indiana filed a lawsuit that claims that the fix violates religious freedom. And the argument that was heard earlier this week made by Jim Bopp, who is a fairly famous defender for religious right organizations in the state, argues that religious groups must discriminate against LGBTQ Hoosiers because their orientation goes entirely contrary to religious folks in the state.
I know that the language gets a little, we have to be careful with this, but is essentially Jim Bopp making the case for the right to discriminate here?
Yes.
Okay.
And that actually is more or less a direct quote from him. And so the interesting thing, ironic or not, the state says that the reason why that argument doesn't hold up is because there isn't evidence that businesses have used RFRA to discriminate against LGBTQ Hoosiers.
Hmm. But with most court cases, something concrete typically has to happen in order to bring a case. For example, if I go to sue my neighbor for theft, mm-hmm. they first have to have stolen from me. What exactly is the particular case that prompted this?
It is the 2015 lawsuit.
It's that, exactly.
Yeah, okay. And it's directly in response to the fix that was passed a week after RFRA.
Ah.
And basically, it's out of the concern, very similar to the way that Planned Parenthood might sue the state after an anti-abortion measure is passed by the legislature. Mm. This is kind of a preemptive lawsuit to argue against what that legislation says.
All right. Well, finally, the UAW strikes continue to be in the news. And we talked about it on Monday's show. We devoted the whole show to it. Today, negotiations are ongoing. Tuesday, the president of the AFL-CIO paid a visit to the Central Indiana General Motors facility. What message did he have for strikers?
Basically, he said, we're in your corner. We've got your back. And we're still at the table. We're still negotiating. And it was very encouraging for folks in Bedford. Business reporter Samantha Horton, actually not our business reporter, Samantha Horton, one of the reporters from the WFIU-TIU in Bloomington, was able to talk to the UAW local president in Bedford about what that visit meant to them. And basically, it was being encouraging, knowing that this big national conversation that's happening, they also care about the folks who are in Bedford, Indiana as well.
A J.P. Morgan estimate stated that the strike has cost GM over $1 billion now. Meanwhile, union members are collecting $250 a week in strike pay.
Mm-hmm.
Are we seeing the financial pressure on both sides start to build?
Yeah, I mean, certainly so. There's a lot of concern from you know, national conversations about how long UAW picketers can remain on the line, especially because that's only $250 a week. The other thing is that GM is starting to receive pressure as well because the UAW essentially has had negotiations with Fiat Chrysler and Ford to negotiate the contracts for their employees. But until General Motors finishes their negotiations with them, those negotiations are also stalled. So there's a lot of pressure for them to get the ball rolling. But the main sticking point still appears to be those temporary workers, folks who have worked for GM for, you know, a handful of years, who still aren't receiving full-time benefits. And basically, UAW trying to make sure that that is included in whatever new negotiation is happening.
The beat goes on. All right. Well, thank you so much, Lauren Chapman, our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We'll see you next Friday for a whole new crop of stories.
See you next Friday.
Up next, we will break down a story from our workforce development reporter, Justin Hicks. A pilot apprenticeship program in Elkhart County is the first of its kind in Indiana. It connects high school students with local businesses. Skilled trades could spark a solution to the state's skilled labor shortage. We'll talk to him in a minute and a half. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Elkhart County recently introduced a new apprenticeship model for high school students. The partnership between schools and businesses could prove to be mutually beneficial for the workforce and young people alike. Indiana Public Broadcasting's workforce development reporter Justin Hicks has been following this story, and he joins us now to fill us in. Justin, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Elkhart County introduced this new apprenticeship program. Can you tell us a little about these new opportunities and who they're geared towards?
Sure, yeah. So the apprenticeship program that was launched by Horizon Education Alliance, or HEA, it's geared towards high school students, and it's meant so that these high school students, for the last 2 years of high school, their junior and senior year, they will learn skills, in some sort of it can be a manufacturing setting, it can be an IT setting. They learn these skills, and they work for a real company for half of the day, and then that third year after they've graduated from high school, they will go on to be a full-time employee of that company.
Who was behind introducing this program to Elkhart?
Yeah, so Horizon Education Alliance, or HEA, they were the ones who launched it, but they had a lot of help from a Colorado nonprofit called CareerWise Colorado. CareerWise Colorado, like I said, it started in Colorado, and they brought that same apprenticeship model to the Bronx, actually, just recently, just before they brought it to Indiana. So now it's their resume reads Colorado, the Bronx, and Indiana.
Well, okay. Is it in just one high school in Elkhart County, or are there a few of them taking advantage?
Yeah, so HEA did a really great job about establishing connections with all the high schools in Elkhart County. So they have some in Goshen, they have some in Elkhart.
What about an apprenticeship program interested Elkhart, I guess? What kinds of needs does a program like this one address?
Yeah, so I mean, it's essentially addressing the need that employers have been saying for a long time that they can't find enough skilled workers. You know, if you are an RV manufacturer, for instance, there's a lot of skilled labor that goes into that. People need to know how to operate these machines that cost millions of dollars and have a very specific skill set to just to code or program them to maybe turn a board 90 degrees to the right or something. You know, it sounds simple, but it's surprisingly complex. So employers have said for a long time they don't have a talent pipeline to do those things. So they're hoping that if they can get these kids who are high schoolers, get them trained, they can build those skills and also give back to the community at the same time.
Do we have a list of the employers who are participating in this? You mentioned RV manufacturers. Mm-hmm. I imagine with the prevalence of RV manufacturers in Elkhart County, there are a few of them who are participating.
Yeah. So, in fact, I think they're sort of indirect suppliers to RV companies. So Robert Weed is one of the biggest that supplies. I want to say it's countertops. I could be wrong. It's wood finishing or countertops, something like that, to RV companies. That's one. Another one that I saw pretty closely, I saw the initial meeting with. I got to sit on the initial meeting. Was with Surf Air Wireless, which is a internet company. They hang lines for internet. And so they were looking for people to get trained in how to do that.
And so these individual businesses are benefiting by finding skilled work or training skilled workers, essentially.
Yep.
And then I guess getting, for lack of a better term, getting their pick of the litter of the best ones after the fact. Or is it mm-hmm. or is it guaranteed of all of these students that they'll get some kind of job?
Yeah. So my understanding is that for that third year, once they graduate from high school, it's guaranteed or at least expected that student will work full time. And I think that there's an agreement with the company as well, where the company is expected to offer them that full time position. You know, I think HEA and CareerWise, they all acknowledge this is a big experiment. So it may not actually work out that way. And if so, that's OK as well. But that's the expectation, is that the student will work full-time on that third year, and that the company will have them and will want them to work full-time that third year.
Yeah, that would be my concern. Like, what if the student wants to stay, but the company doesn't really have a use for them? I guess that's may not be a question you can answer, but I wonder what the out might be there for the company. Are the students benefiting in other ways? They're being paid, I'm assumed, or mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the students are getting paid. And from the one student, I think at different companies it varies a little bit. But the student that I kind of featured in the story that I did, he's actually getting paid better than minimum wage. And for him, that was huge. I mean, it meant that he could actually stay in high school. You know, his parents, he helps out his parents pay bills. And so he was debating whether or not he should drop out of high school because he just needed to make a little bit more money. So I think Robert Weed said they're paying him $13 an hour, $14 an hour, something like that. And, you know, with that, just with that kind of that nice paycheck coming in and working half day during the school week, he's making enough money to stay in school.
So this came along at just the right time for him.
Absolutely.
Between the students and the schools and the businesses, there are a lot of stakeholders here. What are the challenges of getting everyone on board?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the challenge is going to get everyone on board is that it's a logistical nightmare, right? And HEA took that on. They knew that this was sort of a logistical nightmare. And they said, we're going to live that nightmare, I guess, and turn it into a dream, you know? So there's a lot of places around Indiana that I've heard. And in fact, at the launch for the apprenticeship day, several different organizations, one from Indianapolis came, some different chamber of commerces came, and they just wanted to see what this looked like because they were excited and they've said, we've been thinking about this, but we just didn't really know how to do it. And we're a little scared to embark on this journey because connecting the schools and the companies has been really, really difficult because we might get one school interested with kind of like, okay, give us, show us a company and we'll bite. But then they can't find a company or vice versa. So it's really that connecting piece that's been a challenge.
Does it take a heavy manufacturing area like Elkhart County to make something like this happen, do you think?
So not necessarily, because it could be any industry. And I think that's – this apprenticeship model is meant to be copy and pasted, but copy and pasted loosely in any industry. So you could do this with automobile manufacturing, which I guess that's actually manufacturing, to be fair. But yeah, I mean, it could work out in a variety of industries. So actually, I'm looking at some of them right now, some of the different industries that they talk about working with. Healthcare is one that they're looking to get into because there's a healthcare shortage. Financial services. There's actually, bizarrely enough, a shortage of accountants in sort of northern Indiana. So they've also talked about how can we get kids, you know, apprenticing at maybe banks or apprenticing with accounting firms.
So many different kinds of apprenticeships, not just skilled labor, but also, like you said, accounting and things like that.
Yep.
Are there any labor laws involved here?
There are, yeah. So there's obviously child labor laws. These kids are 16, so they're still covered by child labor laws. And an interesting thing is the DOL, the Department of Labor, it's a little confusing, but the Department of Labor regulates certain states in different ways. In Indiana, we are actually regulated by the Federal Department of Labor. Some states have their own state offices. So we have to follow all the federal rules because of that. And the Department of Labor has actually said that if they register an apprenticeship program, if they give their seal of approval, they can actually waive certain child labor laws having to do with like dangerous machinery.
How interesting. Why is it important that these opportunities are being offered to high schoolers specifically? Are there benefits to offering these opportunities at that particular age?
I think the idea is the sooner you get them and the sooner you give them skills, the sooner you can sort of give them options in life. And I think that's kind of the going philosophy here. There's been a lot of apprenticeships that have been geared towards people once they graduate from high school, and it's been sort of an alternative to community college or, of course, an alternative to four-year college. So I think the idea here was let's go ahead and get them these skills, certifications earlier so that way they don't wonder when they graduate from high school, will I go to four-year college or community college? They'll have sort of an idea already of what they want to do.
I'm thinking of when I was in college and there were vocational schools. You know, some kids would leave for half the day and go and learn a skilled trade or something like that. Mm-hmm. But those were schools. This is sort of an immersion in industry type of a program.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between what they're learning here and what they're maybe learning at a vocational school?
Sure. Honestly, not totally sure. And
I would imagine dealing with a boss.
Yeah, yeah,
would be
dealing
one
with a real
thing.
Like right, dealing with a real life boss. And I should add too that in their school day they actually have, I think there's a chunk of time, maybe like one period, is devoted to sort of professional skills. And that's part of this program. When the school said we want to participate in this program, we want to work with these businesses, they also said we're willing to sacrifice one period of the school day so that these kids can get these professional sort of courses and learn how to write emails and learn how to answer phone calls, you know, simple things that, you know, 16-year-old kids need to learn how to do.
Yeah, because that sort of thing is not really – it's hard to teach in school, and it's something that you kind of – I mean, in the professional world, it's something that I'm still learning every day. But you kind of need a foundation to start with.
Yeah.
And for them to do that in this program, is it's interesting how they might approach that. What has the reception been like among the students? Are they excited, or does it depend on the student?
Yeah, it goes a little bit student by student. So there's a dozen students in the program here in the first year. And most of the students that I talked to, I mean, of course, they were very excited. A lot of them also said, too, that you know, so a lot of these students were kind of honor students. They were sort of the best of the best at their schools. So some of these students were saying, I'm going to do this for 2 years, possibly a third. And for them, it was a way to give them options to say, maybe I don't need to go to four-year college, or maybe I'll sort of you know, have this experience and maybe it'll either get me into a better four-year college if I want to do that or just give me an option to not go to college at all.
How do you become selected to participate in this program? Is it competitive?
I believe so. It was a little bit competitive. So the students have to fill out an application. The application this time for the first go around, I think the application was given by guidance counselors. In the future, though, Elkhart County CareerWise has set up an online portal so students can apply online. And again, they're getting guidance counselors to really go into classrooms and say, hey, we have this online portal. Go right now. Apply. And I think the idea is supposed to be that it's going to get more competitive.
Is Elkhart County breaking ground here? Have there been other programs like this in Indiana before?
So this is the first, from what I keep being told, this is the first of its kind in Indiana. And it's the first of its kind, not in the sense that it's a youth apprenticeship, because youth is defined as 16 to 24 by the Department of Labor.
Huh.
So there's a ton of apprenticeships that are already there, like I said, for if you've graduated from high school and you want to sort of full-time work in a factory, but you just don't have like the resume for that. My understanding is this is the first apprenticeship where high school students will be working half day and have that guaranteed sort of third year position afterwards. So it's pretty new in that way.
Do you see an increased movement towards supporting apprenticeship opportunities right now?
Absolutely, yeah. And so apprenticeships have actually been a huge thing even with this current presidential administration. They've said from the White House that they want to see more apprentices, and Indiana has definitely taken that on and taken that to heart.
College is often stressed in high schools, but for some students that path might not be the right fit. Is part of the discussion around apprenticeships making sure that alternative options are being presented to students?
Yeah, and in this apprenticeship specifically, they also make a point of offering you community college credit as part of the apprenticeship program. And that's one part that I didn't cover a ton because I think, again, there's still that's going to happen along the way. They're going to figure out those pieces because they're, like I said, they're piloting this program. But the intention is that when these students leave this program, by that third year, they would have, something about like the equivalent of an associate's degree or something like that.
So you talked about other states that have adopted this. It's been carried out in Colorado, in New York. How has it worked out there?
So my understanding, I'm not entirely sure about the Bronx program. I hear there's a lot of enthusiasm around it. And I think I want to say that they said they were going to maybe expand into Manhattan as well.
Mm.
So I guess that's a good sign.
I would imagine the diversity of opportunity, different opportunities there are a little bit greater than maybe that of Elkhart County.
Sure. Not a lot of manufacturing in New York City. Yeah. sure. Yeah. But I hear in Colorado, it's actually really great as well. I want to say they have somewhere around 100 students in their program around now, 90 to 100 students. So,
what are the goals of the program then?
So the stated goal by the HEA director or the director of student pathways, Jason Harrison, he said several times he wanted to by next year have 300 students in this apprenticeship. So he wants to go from 12 to 300. And
so we're at 12 right now.
Right. So we're at 12. They're at the dirty dozen,
The number of people who've walked on the moon ever. This is a small program right now.
Right. You're right. It's small. It's sort of a pilot program. He's hoping, though, that he can get so much enthusiasm. And he has a lot of enthusiasm, but he's hoping that he can get so much people bought into this thing by next year that he'll have upwards of 300 apprentices. So they've set a really huge goal for themselves. And one thing to note, too, is that the CareerWise Colorado person who's been coming in to sort of help out with this, even she's kind of acknowledged that that's a very, very lofty goal. But she sees that more as a product of their excitement, their enthusiasm. So she doesn't see it as a bad thing. She just sees it as maybe a little unrealistic, but...
Yeah. So what are the challenges then of making that goal a little bit more realistic? I think a lot of effort needs to be put in place.
Yeah. And I think this goes back to that logistical nightmare type thing we were talking about where, essentially they need the companies to actually kind of stop dragging their feet and say, we believe in this idea so much that we will put our money where our mouth is and actually invite a student into our company. And they also need to have... Well, maybe some more people from more schools jump in as well and say, hey, we really like this idea as well. We want to go full steam ahead.
That was my next question. Can we anticipate other communities and other schools to kind of develop these programs that are just like this one?
Yeah, I think so. So like I said, even at that launch, there was some people from Indianapolis, from other areas who were looking at this very, very closely and saying, if you can make it work in Elkhart County – we want to see what you're doing, and we want to copy and paste that to where we are.
I would imagine that the goal by the people who have kind of started this up would be to point at Elkhart County, or want to be pointed at as an example of how the rest of the state can kind of develop economically.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the idea. They know – HEA definitely knows that they are in the forefront of this, and they take that responsibility and honor, you know, really. They don't take it lightly. I think they know that it's a big experiment, and that there's – you know, a lot at stake, but at the same time, that doesn't mean that they're not afraid to play around with it a little bit.
There is, I would imagine, a huge number of people that are involved, or maybe not a huge number of people, but people who, if you're going to get involved with something like this, you really kind of got to get involved. You know, you're making phone calls to these local companies, these manufacturers. Mm-hmm. You're also involved with the school. Who kind of got the ball rolling? Is there a small group of people whose idea this was, from a germ to now the reality of these 12 students?
Yeah, and I think that group of people, there's two people in particular from HEA and Goshen there who really spearheaded this, Jason Harrison and Brianna over there. This was sort of their brainchild, which is my understanding. But they also got a lot of key policymakers in the state interested a couple years ago, when they kind of brought them all on this big trip to Switzerland, because they all went to Switzerland together to just see what they were doing in Switzerland and how that was all going, and, you know, how can we copy sort of their apprenticeship model in Switzerland?
Interesting.
And so
we've gone international with it. Okay.
Right. And so the idea was, how can we take the model that they have in Switzerland and bring it back to Elkhart County?
Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Justin Hicks, thank you so much for filling us in on what's going on in Elkhart County.
Sure. Happy to be here. Yeah.
Up next on the Friday Pitch-In, did you know that in the mid-1800s, there were many significant and successful frontier farms that were started by black pioneers? It's a forgotten piece of Indiana history that author Annalisa Cox has worked hard to dig up, and she'll share it with us next. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We now turn to a conversation I had earlier this week with historian Annalisa Cox, a fellow at the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research at Harvard University. Her book, The Bone and Sinew of the Land, shares the untold story of black pioneers settling in the Midwest and elsewhere among the free North and the forces that were against them at the time. Her recent opinion piece in the New York Times is called When Anti-Immigration Meant Keeping Out Black Pioneers. You start your recent piece for the New York Times with a story about a man named William Brown crossing the Wabash River near the Indiana-Illinois border in the 1850s. Why was he crossing that river, and what happened when he did?
Well, he was crossing that river because it was a state boundary, and he had work on the other side in the state of Illinois. Now, today we think of that region as the Midwest or the Heartland, right? But this is before the Civil War. So there is still pretty serious things going on about states' rights. And entire states, including Midwestern states, were creating anti-immigration laws. They're some of the earliest in our nation, and were against free people of African descent, including people like William Brown, whose ancestors had been, you know, frontiers folk in Indiana for many generations by the 1850s. But when he crossed that river, he was actually breaking Illinois state law. It was not just their law. It was their new state constitution. A white majority had turned its backs on the original rights of people in Illinois and in the Northwest Territory, which had originally said that there should be equal rights, including the right to vote for all men, regardless of the color of their skin. But in 1848, whites in Illinois rewrote the state constitution, saying that taking away almost all rights, those have been taken away for a while, including the right to testify against a white person in court, and also the right to enter the state as a free African-American and find work there, even though there were already thousands of free African-Americans living and working in the state of Illinois, and they had been from its earlier days before statehood. So within 10 days of William Brown arriving in Illinois and taking up work there. He was arrested by the local sheriff in Lawrence County, and under a new and very vicious law that had been passed in 1853 to add teeth to the U.S. state constitution, William Brown was arrested and charged massive amounts of money, not only a very high fine, but all of his legal court costs, jail costs. And when he could not pay those, the state of Illinois said the sheriff had the legal right to sell William Brown into slavery in order to recoup the county's legal costs. And William Brown was put on the steps of the Lawrence County courthouse, and an auction was started.
Oh my goodness.
It's kind of weird to think of the North, particularly the Midwest, which are not slave states, right? Yeah. Before the Civil War, is creating some of these very early and very harsh anti-immigration laws. And very, very famous people were involved in the creation of this new state constitution and the defense of these laws, including somebody that your listeners may have heard of before, Senator Stephen A. Douglas, who was known by many at the time as the Little Giant. He was a renowned politician out of Illinois, had helped to push through the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and there was a lot going on that he was involved in, and he was involved in these very famous debates between himself and a man by the name of Abraham Lincoln.
The Lincoln-Douglas debates, yeah.
Exactly. And he was a huge defender of the 1848 anti-immigration law, as well as the Constitution and the additional law that was created.
Were there reasons given for making them, or was it just sort of the sentiment at the time among the white settlers who were living in the area?
The reasons given was that, and you know, same reasons that were given in the state of Indiana, which passed a similar constitution in 1851, banning further African American immigration to the state, and that was that the state was being flooded with useless, murderous, violent, brown-skinned people, right? Basically, except much worse language was being used than that. Actually, free African Americans had been some of the earliest and some of the most successful settlers on the Midwestern frontier, including in Illinois and Indiana, coming before statehood, buying good land, farming it well, raising their families on that land, in many cases voting under the 1787 Northwest Territorial Ordinance.
Before we get into the rural settlements that you've researched and written about, can we just define quickly that term for our listeners? What was a rural settlement in the mid-1800s?
Right. So this is a bit of a tricky term, because I'm talking about a period in my book, in The Bone and Sinew of the Land, I'm talking about a period that is pre-urban. I mean, we have a lot of myths about the Midwest. And to be clear, I'm talking about a region which was then called the Northwest Territory, which was became the states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And by the time the Civil War broke out, actually by 1860, there were well over 300 rural farming settlements scattered across those five states that were home to numerous propertied and successful African-American farmers. But to be clear, for these earlier groups that were coming in, they weren't thinking of themselves as rural because there was no urban area. This is a pre-urban area. It's the frontier. There's no city of Chicago. There's no city of Indianapolis. You know, there's just there's wilderness, there's indigenous people, but these are not people who are thinking of themselves as rural or farmers. They're much more what we would consider today that heavily loaded term, but pioneers.
How much has been known about these settlements up until now?
Basically, almost nothing. Well, I have to take that back. The descendants of these families, right, the tens of thousands of free African Americans who came out to settle the Midwestern frontier starting just after the American Revolution, some of them had fought as patriots in the American Revolution, they know this story. They have been trying to tell this story. And there has been, I would say that in many ways, this history has been not just forgotten, but unheard or even suppressed. But when I started this work a few years ago at Harvard University, where I'm a non-resident fellow at the Hutchins Center, the general assumption amongst most historians is that there was five, maybe six settlements. They were home to propertied and successful African-American farmers in those five states of the Midwest before the Civil War. By the time my exhibit opened at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture in 2016, I'd found roughly 70 such settlements, which was considered a pretty big deal. By the time my book went to press last year, The Bone and Sinew of the Land, I had found 338 settlements, and I'm finding more all the time.
What made you start looking into these settlements initially?
You know, in all honesty, I did not think I would find this many. I was one of those historians who did not think there were as many as there were. This has been a history that's really been hidden in plain sight. It kind of came out of my first book, A Stronger Kinship, which is about a post-Civil War rural farming community with radically harmonious race relations that arose right after the Civil War in the Midwest. And as I was on book tour for that book, whether I was in Miami, Florida, or Portland, Oregon, people would come up to me and they'd say, well, I'm sure you heard about this particular community or that particular community in the Northwest Territory states. And I hadn't. And it turned out that no historians had been writing about those communities, or very few. Stephen Vincent actually really started the ball rolling with his important book, Southern Seed, Northern Soil, on two rural farming African-American antebellum communities in central Indiana. And he mentioned numbers. He said that there were well over 60,000 free African-Americans living in those five states before the Civil War. The only problem is no historians knew where they were living or what they were doing. So I decided to try to find out.
The thing that I'm curious about is, so farming is it's an entrepreneurial a task, I guess. And so were these pioneers, these black pioneers, farming for themselves, or were they actually selling their goods? And I would imagine that the prejudice that existed at the time kind of limited that.
Actually, these were massive market farmers, and they were incredibly entrepreneurial. So I actually, in my book, I call some of them landed gentry, because by that period sort of definition, they were. They owned hundreds and hundreds of acres. This is before sort of chemicals and tractors allowed people to farm thousands of acres at a time. Sort of the maximum, unless you were using enslaved labor, right? The maximum you could really own and manage was about 900 or 1,000 acres. Some of these African American families had that. And that was, for many of them, that was their goal. They would grow their farms. One of the most amazing stories was Jacob Hawkins, who started with nothing. He actually had to sue for his freedom because he was being held illegally enslaved in Davies County in Indiana. He had to sue for his freedom. So he started with nothing. He just started with himself. And he got married. He had a family. By the time of his death, he owned over 700 acres of land.
That's big for today.
That's big for today. And that is astonishing. So he was putting his goods onto barges on the Wabash River. They were going to the Ohio River. He was selling them in Pittsburgh, St. Louis, maybe even New Orleans, certainly Louisville. These were market farmers.
How hard is it to find out about things like this? Are you just spending years digging through old records until you just start piecing it all together?
It was years of going through old records. A lot of it was census research, which is not exactly thrilling, I will tell you, but it just took a lot of slogging through those numbers. But at the same time, there were some extremely renowned and wealthy free African Americans who did not want to be counted in a federal document after the passage of the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, and including people like John Langston, who was one of the first African Americans to be elected to political office in the United States. And he was living on his farm in Ohio when that occurred in the 1850s. He never allowed himself to be counted on a federal document like the census. So it had to be other sources. And I could not have written this book without the assistance and walking alongside and getting to know the descendants of these families. It was about them getting to know me getting to know them. And after a year or two, somebody saying, well, you know, my auntie, she's moved away, but she's been doing genealogical research. She has the family Bible, which gives the birth dates. And these are birth dates of people who may have been born in what is now Illinois in 1800. Right? Or in Indiana in 1805 or 1810, when there weren't really any kind of official state documents and birth records. So these kind of family records became incredibly important.
Do we know much about what life was like for them living in these settlements?
I worked on finding that out because I'll be honest with you, I know a lot of people hear history or historians, and they think, oh gosh, it's a bunch of names and dates and battles, right? Or it's going to be really boring. But I wrote The Bone and Sinew of the Land, and I tried to write that article in the New York Times as well in a way that would really engage people. I think some of the best compliments I've received is that it reads like a novel. It's all factual, but I actually did. I went back. I talked to people who still farm in the old ways with ox teams to ask them what it felt like to actually push a single blade plow in ground that until recently was forested behind an ox team, what it's like to harvest wheat with a scythe. I got my hands dirty. Let's just put it that way.
can you talk about the impact that these African American pioneers had in Indiana specifically, but also throughout the Midwest during that time?
Yeah. So it's a lot. Basically, rural Indiana before the Civil War was much more racially diverse than it is today. That does not mean it was equal. Diversity is not equal equality, right? I want to stress that. But it was certainly more diverse. And this had a massive impact. It actually, unfortunately, created a lot of prejudiced backlash. And for those of you who do read my book, you'll see I don't use the term racism. It's a 20th century term. So it's actually kind of incorrect. And I was really intrigued by the word prejudice, which is what people were using at that time, because it comes out of the American Revolutionary period and the idea that we had in our Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal with an equal right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And there was an understanding by a lot of people, both white and black, our founding citizens of this nation, that prejudice, any kind of prejudice, including racial prejudice, would be toxic to a democratic republic. So one of the fascinating things you see going on in these state constitutional meetings in Indiana and across the Midwest is that when a prejudiced or racist, what we call racist law, was being considered to be passed, white politicians would stand up and fight hard against it because they said, look, if we allow something as strange and odd as hair texture to exclude a propertied, hardworking man from the right to vote, what's next? The Swedes? I mean, that's actually a quote from a Wisconsin politician from before the Civil War. So there was this intense debate around equality. And I think if we lose this history, we lose that debate. Because so much of the dialogue we think of before the Civil War is slavery versus freedom, right? But actually, there was another dialogue going on that was fueled and kept alive within the Northwest Territory states, and that is equality versus prejudice. And that's one that the Civil War did not overcome. That's one I would argue we're still dealing with today.
Annalisa Cox, she's the author of The Bone and Sinew of the Land. She also recently wrote a piece for The New York Times, When Anti-Immigration Meant Keeping Out Black Pioneers. That was published on September 20th and appears in the September 22nd print edition of The Times. Annalisa, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Matt. Appreciate it.
And that's it for the Friday Pitch-In. I want to thank Indiana Public Broadcasting stations across the state for welcoming all in to their programming schedules on this, our debut week. And most of all, I want to thank you for listening. We'll be back Monday at this time for a show with Indiana Humanities about the Indiana Authors Awards. Have a great, cool autumn weekend. Check out the first quarter moon tomorrow night for International Observe the Moon Night. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In.